I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. North Korean leaders refer to their country as the land of the morning calm. Others see it in a much more sinister light, more like the calm before the storm. Former President Jimmy Carter recently said he considers North Korea's nuclear program the greatest threat to world peace. And the threat's made worse by the fact that the nation is so shuttered off from the rest of the world. It is an enormously difficult place to visit. It's impossible to travel there without government minders. North Korean President Kim Jong-il is secretive, unpredictable, and some say paranoid, and this makes diplomacy difficult. Today we're joined by the U.S. diplomat who has spent the last decade talking and working with North Korean leaders. He was this country's envoy to North Korea up until 6 weeks ago, when he resigned in disagreement with the hard-line stance the administration was taking in negotiations. Connection listeners, what's it going to take to shift North Korea's finger away from the nuclear trigger? If coercive diplomacy doesn't work, well then what does? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And as I mentioned earlier, Ambassador Pritchard is with us for the program. Thanks a lot for agreeing to do this.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
You're just settling into a new job at the Brookings Institution.
That's correct. It's a great place to be. I look forward to continuing my association here for the next year.
Ambassador, let me. I want to talk with you about your experiences in just a moment. But before we start, I thought we could get the latest sort of on-the-ground perspective from North Korea itself. Jeffrey York's a correspondent with Canada's national newspaper, The Globe and Mail, and he recently spent 8 days in North Korea. Jeff went in as part of a Chinese tour group. He's joining us on the line from Beijing. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Jeff, you write about the brainwashing and the propaganda, but you've worked in China and in Russia and all the former Soviet states. Have you ever seen anything like what you saw in Pyongyang?
No, I never have. I mean, it's clearly the world's most isolated state, a state where there is total control of information flowing in. There's only really one television channel, one radio station. Unless you are very, very close to the Chinese border, which is a pretty small percentage of the population, you really have no access to outside information. Even top people, even middle level or top people in the government have no access to the internet. It's only a tiny elite, even within the government, that has access to the internet. So this is a country that's totally cut off and therefore very easy for a government to control through a very systematic system of propaganda that they've been building for 50 years, and they're able to really control all the information that people have and to control their perception of the outside world.
Jeff, what were you able to see? You write about watching people actually gathering grass beside the road, grass to eat?
Yes. They appear to take grass and other wild foods, herbs and so on, and from what the aid workers say, they use this to mix in with other food they might have, like corn and so on, to stretch out their meals, to create sort of a gruel that will make their rather meager rations last longer. Aid workers have told me that over the course of a few weeks, they would see hundreds of people gathering grass and wild food. I was there for 8 days. I saw dozens. Every day I saw people gathering grass, even on highway medians, even within Pyongyang, which is clearly the most privileged city in North Korea, a city where only the most trusted people are allowed to live. Even there, people are gathering grass to eat.
You also describe the scraggly and underfed soldiers at the sides of the roads, sort of desperately trying to flag rides home or back to wherever they're stationed. Did you get a chance, Jeff, to get close enough to anybody in North Korea to hear from them what they think about the outside world, something that gives us a sense of how they approach the negotiating table?
Well, I don't think people in North Korea are even allowed to have independent thoughts. So it's difficult to believe that anybody has thoughts that go much beyond what is drummed into them by the propaganda. And for more than 50 years, they have been told that the United States is their sworn enemy. It's an imperialist nation that is sworn to wipe them out. And every visitor to Pyongyang is taken to the Korean War Museum, which they call the Victorious Fatherland War, where they are taken invariably to the Hall of American Atrocities, where they are told with very graphic exhibits that the Americans are war criminals who slaughter and massacre people. And this is the message that is just drummed into them day after day, every moment of their lives. And they seem to believe it. I saw no evidence that they see the Americans in any other way.
Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey York is a correspondent with the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. Now to Ambassador Charles Pritchard. As I mentioned earlier, he was Special Assistant to the President, Senior Director for Asian Affairs, a former military man. He was most recently America's Special Envoy for negotiations with North Korea. And, Ambassador, I gather you go by the name of Jack. Is it all right if I call you Jack?
Please do.
You listen to Jeff's description, Jack. The starving families, a land where, as he said, independent thought itself is all but banned. How do you talk to the leaders of a country like that?
Well, one, Jeff's description is pretty accurate. It mirror the things that that I've seen and noticed over the years as well. But I'm also not, and American diplomats are not, dealing with the rank and file of North Korean people. We're dealing with a more sophisticated diplomatic corps, a small number of people who do have access to the outside. To give you an example, the current ambassador to the United Nations from North Korea came here in January of 2002. He had previously been their ambassador to the United Nations for some 8 years with a four-year break. So they recycle people in. At the next level down, people that we work with, their current deputy perm rep, number two guy who handles American affairs, is also in a similar situation. He's there now with the rank of ambassador. He was there 4 years ago as a minister counselor. The person that he replaced is now back as the Deputy Director for American Affairs, a job that he also held once before. So a small number of people who are exposed to the outside, who do have access to news reporting. If you happen to call the North Koreans' UN mission, if you're lucky to get through and you're put on hold, it's usually CNN that's piped into the headset. So the diplomats abroad have access to information, a small number of people in North Korea. But there's the difference. Those are the kinds of people that we are dealing with, and over time you would be hard-pressed to distinguish them in terms of personality and their personal life from a lot of other diplomats that you deal with.
Now, it was almost exactly a year ago when, in one session of talks, the North Koreans told the United States that they had or were working on nuclear weapons, and it's been a whirlwind year of conversations, international conversations. And many of the reports that we've heard over that time, Jack, describe a negotiating table where the North Koreans are quite unpredictable, taking sort of irrational stances or changing their mind from the morning to the afternoon. What's it like to be on the other side of the table, if in fact that's a fair description of what the table's like?
It is, and I've got to tell you, when I first began dealing with the North Koreans, I'm sure that my reaction was very similar to what others have in their first or second encounter with the North Koreans. You think, you know, this is not really possible. This is not the way diplomacy is supposed to work. But the North Koreans operate on their own timetable. They have a pattern of kind of one step forward, two steps backwards. It does make negotiating difficult. It certainly makes it a requirement to stay engaged over the long term because progress is very slow. Rather than be exasperated on the initial encounter with the North Koreans, you kind of settle in and look for the opportunities to move U.S. national interests forward.
I mentioned a couple of minutes ago what Jimmy Carter said, that he feels North Korea's nuclear threat's the greatest current threat to world peace. Do you agree with that? Do you think that Kim Jong-il would actually use a nuclear weapon?
I would hope the answer's no, but the problem is the stakes are too high to bet in that kind of a fashion. The situation is very simple. North Korea does have nuclear weapons. They have unfrozen their plutonium production facilities. They are in the process, if they have not actually completed, as they've claimed, reprocessing spent fuel rod that would allow them to make perhaps another six or so nuclear weapons, giving them just under 10, if our estimate is accurate. But what's more troubling is this is a country that has absolutely no need for nuclear weapons, not as a deterrent or any other reason. If this situation is left unchecked, they will continue this process of feeding new fuel into their 5-megawatt reactor. They will continue the construction and building of their what used to be a covert, highly enriched uranium, HEU program. They will finish building their 50-megawatt reactor. They will complete the construction on their 200-megawatt reactor. And in the estimates of former Ambassador Bob Gallucci, we could be faced with a situation in not too distant future, a few years down the road, where North Korea is a serial producer in the order of some 30 nuclear weapons per year. Do we really, in the post 9/11 environment, want to have a country that has absolutely no use for nuclear weapons, its economy is an absolute wreck, who is being isolated day by day in possession of excess nuclear weapons and technology that could find its way onto the black market or find its way into the hands of non-state players? And the answer is clearly no, we don't. So in that regard, while it is not the most pressing crisis today in terms of Kim Jong-il with his finger on the trigger, as you described going into this, but it is a very serious situation that must be tackled expeditiously.
Is it your view that the people in the administration now are tackling that as expeditiously with that understanding of the threat?
No, it's not. We're now 2.5 years into the administration. As you point out, I was part of until about 6 weeks ago, that the approach has been undue patience. And patience is a virtue in some situations, but perhaps in this case, undue patience. It's one in which there is not, in my opinion, a dedicated, sustained, and serious effort to go after the resolution of this problem.
And is that because the control rests too much in the White House, not enough in State Department? Is that a simple way of looking at it?
Well, no. It's not that simple. Different administrations operate in different manners. The previous administration, for which as a United States Army officer I was part of until I retired and then was retained in a civilian capacity in the previous administration, by and large, it was a shared responsibility with the White House taking a great deal of effort and lead. But at any rate, it's something that needs to be worked on.
Connection listeners, the threat from North Korea. We're talking about that this hour. It's not going anywhere. In fact, as Ambassador Pritchard is describing, North Koreans are moving ahead with their plans to have as large a system of producing nuclear weapons as they're going to be able to do. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Support. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Ambassador Jack Pritchard, former special envoy to North Korea under President Bush, was special assistant under Clinton and senior director of Asian affairs, has years of experience dealing with the North Koreans specifically. He is now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and talking with us about his view of what's going on in that country and in relations between the United States and North Korea. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'd like to just, Jack, find out a little bit more about how things have changed. Because if we go back, I guess, not quite 2 years, people in North Korea woke up to find themselves on the United States axis of evil. Earlier this year, they watched the U.S. Engage in this preemptive strike against Iraq. Now, there were and are many people in the administration who said that's exactly what we need to do. We need to show the North Koreans we are willing to behave that way. We need, in a sense, to frighten them into backing off their nuclear program. Can that work?
Well, it could work if North Korea were an island nation somewhere in the middle of the Pacific and it had no neighbors. But the truth here is the Korean Peninsula is divided. The southern portion, the Republic of Korea, ought to control the pace and the outcome of the final resolution of the peninsula. We all have a stake in the nuclear issue. But for those to suggest that we ought to send a signal to the North Koreans that we're prepared for some type of unilateral preemptive military strike, it goes straight to the heart of we're prepared to fight to the last South Korean. It's an immature approach and does not take our very good ally into consideration, and they certainly want to avoid a second Korean War.
But help me see it in terms of bilateral relations. People inside the White House today could make the case that while there has not been another war started on the Korean Peninsula, neither has there been a great deal of progress even since that time in the early 90s when you led negotiations for the framework agreement, that the people say that, you know, the North Koreans have just plugged away building up their nuclear program. They needed a wake-up call like this.
Well, let the facts speak for themselves. Former Ambassador Bob Gallucci actually led the negotiations in 93 and 94 that resulted in the agreed framework. A lot of people in both sides, Democrat, Republican, would say, well, it's not an ideal solution. Yeah. And it probably isn't, but it certainly probably was the best solution that could be achieved at the time. And what it did from October of 1994 until January of this year, it froze the North Koreans' plutonium production capability. Had that not occurred, North Korea today would be in possession of some 30 to 50 nuclear weapons. Somewhere around that. Others estimate even more, up to 100. That's a situation that was avoided. The North Koreans, we have now found out, have cheated on the spirit of that agreement by attempting to put together a HEU, highly enriched uranium program, certainly in violation of their agreement with South Korea and absolutely in violation of the intent and spirit of the bilateral agreement with the United States. Does that mean they can't be trusted? Well, yes. Does that mean we should never deal with them and attempt to resolve the problem? No. Are we better off today with a North Korea that only has in its possession perhaps one or two nuclear weapons that it had prior to the agreed framework going into effect 9 years ago? Certainly we're better off. So in that respect, we need to address the reality of the situation and solve the problem we have now rather than throw a little temper tantrum of you can't deal with bad people. Lots of bad people in the world still need to deal with them.
And is that the nub of the disagreement that you had with the administration, that there was too much of a sense that, you know, these are bad people? I'll quote President Bush in reference to Arafat. He's a loser, and I'm not going to spend my political capital on losers. Is it too much of that attitude and not enough of the need to continue engaging? Is that what led you to resign?
Well, there's specifics in terms, and while it may benefit me to go back and revisit the history and kind of spruce up why I resigned very specifically because I was brought into the administration based on my nonpartisan experience of dealing with the North Koreans to be the lead negotiator. When we set up the April trilateral talks in Beijing. The North Koreans agreed to come. They declared that their head of delegation would be Ambassador Lee Gun, a person that I know better than anyone inside or perhaps only a couple people outside of government. Mm-hmm. A person that I have dealt with, someone that we have worked together closely to find resolutions to smaller problems, but nonetheless, someone that I know very well. It was a conversation in the State Department that was attributed to the White House not having confidence in my ability in a very neutral way to lead those negotiations that caused me to resign. If there was no reason for me to be there, there was no reason for me to be there. Now, separately, I do disagree on the methodology of getting to the end game. I don't disagree on what the end game ought to be. We need to have a non-nuclear Korean Peninsula. I think the American objective of ultimately having a united Korean Peninsula under South Korean governance in a democratic non-nuclear state is absolutely correct. But again, how that comes about is mostly for the people of South Korea to determine. So my point here is, if we stand back and do nothing, we will watch North Korea at their own pace and their own judgments become a declared nuclear weapons state with an arsenal for which they have absolutely no need or justification for having. My point is you must engage them very closely, very deliberately. The method of engagement has nothing to do with what you ultimately agree as to what the resolution is. So there's where we are today.
You have so much experience in international diplomacy. I want to make sure that I understand whether or not what you're saying here is that the administration is taking the wrong particular approach with North Korea, or whether or not the administration has in some way changed the way it deals internationally with all its partners and enemies. Which is it?
Well, first, I don't want to stray too far into areas in which I'm an observer and not an expert. So let me focus on Korea as the example. The broad objectives and goals are fine. This is an international problem. I'm talking about the nuclear issue here.
Right.
It is not a bilateral problem between the United States and North Korea. Bringing together the six parties is the appropriate way to do this. Each of those parties have a unique contribution to make to what the resolution may look like. But to try to conduct those negotiations in plenary session, six parties in one room, it just suggests that people don't understand how the North Koreans behave. Is it any surprise, or should it have been any surprise to anyone in this administration that the North Koreans did not agree to another round of talks after the last set in Beijing in August, that they've announced that they've finished their reprocessing of the 8,000 spent fuel rods, and yet they and again they've emphasized that they've never agreed to go to another round? Not only should that not have been a surprise, it was absolutely predictable in advance. So the point comes within the context of a multilateral forum, which is absolutely correct. There needs to be a sustained direct contact between the United States and North Korea, just as there is a sustained direct bilateral contact between Japan and North Korea, between South Korea and North Korea, between Japan, between China and North Korea, and Russia and North Korea. Not only is there nothing wrong with it, it is a requirement. Do we really want to be sitting in a six-party session and having the Chinese and the Russians develop the language that might ultimately come out of there that might obligate the United States with regard to our relationship with North Korea concerning security arrangements or security assurances? And the answer is no, we don't. We ought to be taking the lead talking directly with the North Koreans, formulating what is in our own best interest, what's acceptable to us, coordinating with our allies and our friends in those six-party talks, using their contacts and their information to refine what we can do, how we can get the best deal possible for the interests of the American people and for security in the region.
Ambassador, let me widen it out and bring some of our callers in. We have a number who want to join us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Louisville, Kentucky, Bob's calling in. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I saw an excerpt on the History Channel some time ago, and where Madeleine Albright had met with the leader of North Korea. And at the beginning of your report, you characterized the leader of North Korea as paranoid and secretive and a lot of negative terms, when in fact, History Channel had summarized the engagement by Madeleine Albright at that time as more open, willing to offer more than what they expected, a lot of very positive terms. And then at the change of the administration, when the Republicans came in, or President Bush, they just trashed everything that had been done before. And I'm wondering if the characterization where we have, you know, labeled him as an axis of evil, or the nation's axis of evil, how really productive that is.
No, it's a great question, Bob, and in fact, Jack Pritchard was the person who set up that visit with Madeleine Albright into Pyongyang. So which is the correct characterization of this leader, Kim Jong-il?
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question, Bob, and I appreciate the opportunity to respond. I was with Madeleine Albright when we met with Kim Jong-il on the 23rd and 24th of October in 2000. But let me set the stage first. Up until about April of 2000, the world's characterization of Kim Jong-il was very much as you described that, as a kind of wild and crazy guy. Then all of a sudden we began to get a recharacterization of him as a regional and potential worldly leader. And this was the setup for the June meeting between the South Korean President Kim Dae-jung and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. The South Koreans certainly couldn't allow their president to go visit Pyongyang to meet with an unstable character. So they began to become a little bit more realistic in their characterization of him. My own views of watching Kim Jong-il in his interaction with Secretary Albright at the time was that he certainly pays attention to the regional issues. He listens to the news. He watches Japanese television. This is a country where clearly knowledge is power, and he controls most of it. He was more rational, but this is also, we cannot dismiss the history. This is also the man that even before he became the actual leader upon the death of his father in July 1994, he was in charge of the day-to-day activities that ended up in the blowing up of an airline over Thailand, the attempt and the partial success to blow up the South Korean cabinet in Burma. This is the guy, after he became the leader, who sanctioned the submarine incursion in September 1996 into South Korea, where the commandos, upon the submarine becoming beached, murdered the crew and then escaped through South Korea in a bloody path, all but one being killed by the South Koreans along the way. So we can't dismiss history and what he is representative and what he is capable of, but he certainly displayed the ability to interact at the level of Madeleine Albright, and he certainly has done this with other regional leaders as well. So he's not the cartoon characterization of someone you cannot deal with. It just requires you pay attention to all aspects of who he is and what element that we can trust and what we need verification on.
All right, Bob, thanks for that call. Let's go to Holliston, Massachusetts. Now Jack's joining us. Hi, Jack.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Ambassador, maybe you could enlighten me. There's a lot of people like me, I think, out there. We get the feeling that what it's all about basically is they want aid from us, and they're just like blackmailing us, give us financial help, help us with food production. And that seems to be, people like me seem to get that feeling. Maybe you can enlighten me on this.
Good question, Jack. Is it blackmail, the building up the nuclear side in a pitch to get fuel and food and money?
No, it's not. But you also can't dismiss the perception that Jack has and a lot of Americans have, a lot in this administration, in terms of the North Koreans are out to get economic assistance from us. But I think they're two separate issues. They certainly did not embark upon a nuclear program with the aim of somehow extorting food assistance or other things from the international community. They have been in a terrible situation over the last several years with the demise of the Soviet Union and the patronage in the levels that they've had previously from China, et cetera. Whether market economy or controlled economy, all these things have just come down in the last several years, as we all know, that have produced a famine that has resulted in some estimates of the death of perhaps 10% of the population, some 2 million or more people. They do seek economic assistance. They do seek food aid. They have, in negotiations, opened themselves up to trade. We'll stop this particular act in exchange for some hundreds of thousands of tons of economic assistance.
But you have to know that Kim Jong-il was watching the U.S. attack on Iraq and thinking to himself, if we have the bomb, we have the protection from just that same sort of attack.
Well, here's the logic, it's reasonable and perverse at the same time. The North Koreans, one, have had their nuclear program long before we thought about Afghanistan, Taliban, Saddam, and Iraq. But they've taken and internalized those lessons as they've seen them, and that is, if you don't have a weapons of mass destruction deterrent, you are subject to attack. If you have them, then you're safe.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Ambassador Jack Pritchard, most recently U.S. Envoy to North Korea, and a man with a great deal of experience staring across the negotiating table at the people on the other side, and an opportunity for you to find out what that's like and to better understand relations between this country and North Korea. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Connection listeners, what is the best way to avoid a nuclear crisis in North Korea? Is it those slow and intricate negotiations that don't make for particularly dramatic headlines? Or is it a hardline approach, which appears to be one preferred by the Bush administration? My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. And my guest this hour is Ambassador Jack Pritchard, former Special Envoy to North Korea under President Bush, was also Deputy Chief Negotiator for U.S.-Korea Peace Talks in 97, and Special Assistant under Clinton and Senior Director of Asian Affairs in the year 2000, up to the year 2000. Our numbers, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Brad's been waiting on the phone. Hi, Brad, go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Pritchard, first of all, thank you for your service to your country. Now, my question is pretty clear-cut. I'm looking, intelligence-wise, do you think there's anything that gives us an indication that North Korea may push nuclear secrets out or actual weapon systems to either terrorists, the black market, third world countries? And then the follow-up is, if you were president, what would you do?
First of all, thanks very much for the comment on service to country. My father spent 29 years in the Army. I spent over 28. My son is an active duty Army officer just back from Iraq. So we have a history of service to country, and so thanks very much for that. Secondly, on your first question on would North Korea proliferate their nuclear weapons and technology, they haven't done that yet, but the history of their proliferation in terms of their missile program suggests that if they were pushed into a corner, isolated with excess of material, that you cannot discount the possibility that this stuff would end up someplace else, either in barter or deliberate, and that's the risk that we face. To answer your question, what would I do if I had the opportunity? I would accelerate the coordination that we have with our allies on this. I would open up a channel of direct dialogue with the North Koreans. I would probably go to the formula that, quite frankly, that it, when it first came up in the Clinton administration, I was a little opposed to, but that is to appoint a policy coordinator, a single person of a sufficient rank to bridge the gap between each of the departments within the administration, as former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry did under the Clinton administration, someone who can translate the broad guidance from the president into effective implementation to deal with North Korea.
If I understand what the North Koreans have been saying over the past year, it was particularly last winter a really strident demand for those one-on-one conversations with the United States. The Bush administration at the time was saying, no, this will be done multilaterally. We're not going to talk to you one-on-one as long as you have your nuclear program. Is that a fair characterization of how the conversation was going, say, 6 months ago?
It is, but let's go back to the beginning of the Bush administration, and that is there was a policy review that culminated in June of 2001, in which I was dispatched to talk to the UN ambassador, the North Korean ambassador, and in which I delivered a letter to him, to my counterpart, the vice minister in North Korea, saying what the president had declared, that we were willing now to have a serious discussion and engagement with North Korea over these issues that the president had raised then. It was only in the aftermath of the discovery of the secret HEU program that they developed a "we will not talk to you" policy.
That was a year ago, just now.
That's correct. October 3, 4, and 5, we went to Pyongyang to confront the North Koreans on the intelligence that we had on their covert HEU, highly enriched uranium program.
So you knew about that at the time, because I remember the news of that being characterized as something of a shock, that the North Koreans turned around and said, yep, we got them, and we're building them.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me set the stage here. We were attempting to deal bilaterally with the North Koreans, had essentially set up a meeting that would have taken place on the 10th of July, but there was an incident between the North and the South navies in the West Sea in which a South Korean ship was sunk. We terminated that request for a meeting, and then we, during that intervening period, our intelligence came together very focused on what was going on with regard to the HEU program. We changed our approach, asked for and received a meeting, again, 3, 4, and 5 October of a year ago. The North Koreans were not expecting us to come and talk to them about HEU. They were expecting us to come with what they believed the original 10 July meeting was set up to do and talk about the future of the relationship.
Right.
But that's not but to go to your point is, while we had discussed the possibility, I don't think anybody actually believed it would occur. So when we sat there and listened to a very defiant North Korean essentially admit to their HEU program, we were surprised a bit.
That sounds like a little bit of diplomatic understatement. Let's go to East Kingston, New Hampshire now. Susan's been waiting on the line. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I was curious about how long North Korea can go on working in, well, if they are working independently and producing these weapons, and if not, who are they dependent upon, and are we addressing their allies besides their immediate neighbors?
What do you mean by who are they dependent on, Susan?
How is North Korea funding and subsidizing this, you know, this intelligentsia, this production of their nuclear weapons?
All right, and to follow on that, then what should the U.S. policy do to stop that?
Great, or the multilateral policy.
Okay,
yes.
Great. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
Yeah, there are several embedded questions and answers in that, a terrific point. North Korea, by and large, is not dependent in terms of funding, although I had a question the other day at a panel that I was on that suggested some of the cash that was going from South Korea to North Korea was being funneled into their coffers in order for them to go on to the open market to purchase some of the expensive and complex equipment that's needed in their covert HEU program. You know, I don't know that. You know, funds like food is fungible, and I'm sure some of it goes in that direction. But they're not, as an example, dependent upon sources of from another country. They have developed their technology originally from transfers from Russia, the former Soviet Union, in a peaceful manner, for which they've adopted into this nuclear weapons program. The speculation is that they began their HEU program with a connection, a barter connection with Pakistan. But essentially, they're capable of continuing on this track without any outside sourcing per se. Now, what can be done about it? One of the things, as an example, we were very concerned about their proliferation of long-range missiles. Well, we can talk to them till we're blue in the face, and if they don't agree, and we haven't been successful in the past with our missile talks, they're going to continue to proliferate those. But you can go to the purchasers, those who particularly are friends or allies of the United States, and put diplomatic pressure on them to stop their activities. And we have done that with some degree of success. That ought to continue.
Who are we talking about here? Pakistanis? Are we talking about countries in the Middle East? Who are the principal purchasers?
I'm going to raise some eyebrows here, so I'll stay away from naming specific countries. But yes, to both the characterization of the region and of the specific country involved. The president in May in Poland announced a proliferation security initiative, which on the surface is absolutely makes sense, that a group of nations would get together to find ways to stop the transfer of weapons of mass destruction. Now, the North Koreans correctly saw this as directed against them, and I don't have any particular qualms about that. It's, how does this fit in our overall context of a policy? How do we employ that? That's what's needed. So there are some basic things that the administration is doing, looking at the purchasers of equipment and trying to stop it that way, putting together contingency planning if we're ever lucky enough to have the intelligence, if the North Koreans decide to transfer actual weapons of mass destruction, to be able to interdict that. That's a very iffy proposition. And so rather than leave things up to chance, it is necessary to expand the direct contact with the North Koreans within the context of the six-party or the multilateral framework.
Let me see if I can squeeze in one more call here to Charleston, South Carolina. Larry's joining us now. Hi, Larry.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. At risk of sounding like a possible conspiracy theory person, it's been suggested that with so many people in the current administration having been like veterans of the Cold War, you know, with Bush with his father and Cheney, they opted, for example, instead of tackling and staying the route with Afghanistan, you know, going for something that they knew, as far as attacking Iraq as being, you know, something more where we know we have a definable enemy.
You mean too much of the sort of black and white view of the world, the Cold War mentality,
yeah,
of good guys and bad guys?
Yes, and also, you know, it being said that, the Cold War was, you know, good business for, like, the military-industrial complex, more or less, and a lament that, yeah, things aren't as black and white as they were, and that held, you know, a lot of things in check by having a definable enemy, you know. And so I was just wondering if there's any, you know, does anybody have any suspicions that possibly, you know, there might be a desire to foster an environment that, you know, has this sort of world in strife as a sort of security.
And let me take it from there. Does that mean that it's awkward or difficult for the people who are in the administration now to deal with the type of nuance or to deal with this in the way that perhaps North Korea demands?
And I guess you want me to respond.
Yeah.
I don't believe there's a conspiracy theory going on here that someone is deliberately trying to rekindle the good old days of the Cold War, black and white, good versus evil. I think there are just a lot of things on the plate of the president right now. We have a situation, without going into how we got there, that must be seen through in Iraq. You have a continuing concern in Afghanistan and throughout the world. It may genuinely be tough to pay attention to all the critical parts, but this is one that genuinely needs a great deal of focus by very knowledgeable people.
And Ambassador, what is it like for you? It's been just 6 weeks since you handed in your papers, and that's a very short period of time after decades of being at the hard and all-consuming edge of international diplomacy. It must be strange for you to be a visiting fellow at Brookings rather than picking up your secret briefing notes every morning.
Well, I thought it would be much more difficult than it actually is. To put in a plug to the Brookings Institute, it's a wonderful place, a wonderful environment. I'm doing a lot of speaking, a lot of traveling, and so there's a liberation, a freedom in which that as a team player in the administration, you fought the good fight, and then when the decisions were made, you did your best to support them as you could, even if they were flawed. Well, I'm not in that position any longer, and I can speak out and try to.
But hard, I would imagine, hard to have been serving your country as specifically and directly, and then to stop as suddenly as you did.
Well, it's the only thing I've known for more than 35 years in my adult life. I went from college into the Army, and this has been my only transition out of government. A public servant to the core, it is hard, but I think I'll adjust just fine.
It's been wonderful hearing you speak about it on the program today. I want to thank you for being with us.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
Ambassador Jack Pritchard is former special envoy to North Korea under President Bush, now a visiting fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. And earlier this hour, we talked with Jeffrey York. He's an Asia correspondent for the Toronto Globe and Mail based in Beijing. We had help with our program today from Glenn Alexander, Matt Largie, Kim Bichari, John Hoder, Darren Minucci, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.